Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with photographer Richard Sexton, whose new book is Creole World, Photographs of New Orleans and the Latin Caribbean Sphere. We'll also hear from debut novelist Justin Goh, whose book is The Steady Running of the Hour. And we'll visit with Beth Ann Fennelly and Tom Franklin, authors of the novel The Tilted World. Whether or not you know it, your visual perception of New Orleans has probably been shaped by the photography of Richard Sexton. His many books include New Orleans, Elegance and Decadence, Vestiges of Grandeur, The Plantations of Louisiana's River Road, and New Roads and Old Rivers, Louisiana's historic Pointe-Coupee Parish. He recently received the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities Michael P. Smith Award for Documentary Photography. And today we'll be talking about a gorgeous new book, Creole World, Photographs of New Orleans and the Latin Caribbean Sphere, just published by Historic New Orleans Collection, accompanying an exhibit there. Richard, welcome back to The Reading Life.
Thanks for having me.
This book has its origins in a trip you took a very long time ago, doesn't it?
It does, all the way back to 1974. It's the 40th anniversary of that trip. I was 20 years old, last year of college, and I went to South America in a Datsun station wagon, made it all the way to Bolivia and back.
How like a guy to remember the car.
Spent a lot of time in that car.
Yeah, I bet. Now, Creole is a word that's so loaded with associations. It's provoked such debates in New Orleans, particularly
yes,
always.
Absolutely.
So what does it mean to you for the purposes of this book?
For the purposes of the book, I define it this way. Something that is Creole is a hybridized entity connected culturally or genetically to the old world, but created in the new.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's very general, and you can drive a truck through it. But it's kind of what you have to do with a word like this. It's a word with a lot of regional variation, and it's a word that has a lot of soft edges on its definition. And throughout the broader Creole world, you see it used quite differently, too. It means different things in different places, so that's another part of its complexity.
And I love one reference to it as creativity coming out of chaos, or creative chaos.
Yes, I think that's from Jay Edwards' essay. And I probably wrote something similar to that in the section called Urban Vortex.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that creolization, this process of the creating of something new from the old, is very much related to something I call the urban vortex. It's like all of these different groups coming together and interacting with one another and seeing all these different things and crafting something in common out of it.
Yeah, and you've spent a lot of time thinking about cities and the way they work and
exactly
how they do craft that
urbanism
kind of culture.
And the importance of the city to culture throughout time is a topic of great interest to
mm-hmm.
me.
You know, sometimes I think the whole process of becoming a New Orleanian is creolization.
Oh,
in a way,
definitely.
You know?
Definitely.
We all undergo it, whether or not we
That's
know
right.
it.
You will not find a similar Protestant zeal for a carnival
right.
anywhere else in the country. So there's something infectious about mm-hmm. New Orleans.
So you've been really traveling around the Caribbean Sphere in New Orleans, retracing some of your steps, adding to things you saw that first trip for this book. Talk about some of the similarities you find between New Orleans and those places.
Well, there are many visual similarities in the cities, in the architecture and its form, but also at the cultural level. For instance, there is an intimate attitude toward the street as this kind
yes.
of public space. You see that. Now, people who come from other parts of the United States to New Orleans, they definitely sense that. But if you go to Latin America, you find out that New Orleans is not that unique. It's unique in the sense that it's in another country. But if you compare it to the world that it's really culturally connected to, the Creole world, you see that New Orleans is actually typical.
Mm-hmm. But the colors always the get color. Me, you know, just that feeling, mm-hmm. the light.
And in my view, the color comes from Africa. I mean, you don't see that in Europe. In the same way. I think that's one of the African contributions is the color.
Now, there are two wonderful essays you've included in this book. One is by J.D. Edwards, who wrote the introduction, and John Lawrence, who wrote an essay called Photographing a Creole World as well. What's it like for you as a photographer to turn over your work to these interpreters?
Well, it's interesting to see how other people look at your photographs.
Mm-hmm.
It's always a little bit different from your own. But that, in a way, is a validation that there's a kind of art in them. Because that's the thing about art. People see in it what they want to see. It means different things to different people in the way that they relate to it. And like Walker Percy said, the purpose of art is really reaffirming what people already know. And so I think that's one of the things we do. You try to show things to people that they're going to relate to and they're going to understand, and it's going to mesh in with some aspect of their lives and resonate.
Well, my favorite chapter in this, and I think it's largely because I've looked at your work for so many years that it's kind of trained me to like this,
mm-hmm.
and it's that chapter called Frayed Elegance.
Oh, yes.
I mean, the Hotel Miramar.
Yes.
It's just
Villa Miramar.
Villa Miramar.
And Port-au-Prince.
And it's so amazing because it could be on Esplanade Avenue without batting an eye.
Oh, absolutely.
You know?
Absolutely, it could be. And that's something that readers will see as they look at this book. They're going to be constantly reminded of New Orleans.
Yep.
And they're also going to be confused about where they are. I mean, you're jumping around all over the place. You know, you're in Havana one second, and you're in Port-au-Prince, and you're in New Orleans, and you're in Panama or Cartagena. And you see this thread weaving everything together. And here's this magnificent villa in Port-au-Prince that's named after a locale in Cuba that could easily be located on Esplanade Avenue.
Exactly. This is a book where you really need to read the captions very carefully.
You pay attention to where you are because you're all over the place.
Well, it's a glorious book. We've been talking with Richard Sexton, whose new book is Creole World, Photographs of New Orleans and the Latin Caribbean Sphere. You can meet him Tuesday, April 22nd from 6 to 8 at the Historic New Orleans Collection's Laura Simon Nelson Galleries, 400 Charter Street, and again Tuesday, April 29th at 6 at Octavia Books. Thank you so much, Richard.
Thanks for having me.
Justin Goh's The Steady Running of the Hour is one of the most anticipated novels of the spring. It's the story of a young man who must prove that he's the heir to a huge fortune, and he must do this by tracing a remarkable love story that takes place in the early 1920s against the backdrop of the Great War and the conquest of Mount Everest. It's a completely compelling premise with fascinating characters, and the backstory? That's just as good. We'll talk about the novel and the quest to write it, which included a stop in New Orleans with novelist Justin Goh. Justin, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Now, the plot of The Steady Running of the Hour is fairly complex. So could you describe these interconnected stories?
Yeah, it's about a young American who finds he may be heir to the fortune of this British mountaineer, who was also a soldier in World War I, who left his money to a woman, sort of a mysterious lover. And if the young American can find and prove that he's related to this woman, then he can inherit the fortune. This all happened in 1924. So the young man goes across Europe. His name is Tristan, searching for traces of the past.
And a lot of this began with your own personal fascination with those who sought to conquer Mount Everest, and one particular expedition, I think.
Yes, the 1920s expeditions to Everest, and the 1924 one is the most famous because George Mallory famously disappeared trying to climb Everest, and no one knows whether he and his partner ever reached the top. So at the heart of that story, there's always been this mystery. It's the great mystery of mountaineering, and I think that always appealed to me. The book is in a lot of ways about mystery, and I don't know, that became kind of a symbol for the whole plot.
And then so much of it is about World War I, as you say. And was that always a compelling interest for you, or was that part of the big research you had to do?
No, all this stuff was actually just things that I'd always been interested in. And they became part of the book only because I was writing. I mean, for years, I just wrote stuff that was related to my personal life. And history was a separate interest. I just studied history in college, and I read this kind of stuff for fun. And one day, though, I got the idea of this story, and that's how it all started. So I did research for years and years, and it never ended. But it had already been part of my life for a long time.
Now, the quest to write this novel literally became your life for several years. And you did that thing that so many people dream about. You ditched the real job and you took off to write the book.
Yeah, I think I couldn't even quite believe that I was doing it at the time. But after college, I'd had this sort of nomadic bohemian life, and I had traveled around Europe, and I'd had these intense experiences living in Paris and trying to write a novel. And that had never really panned out. And eventually, I wound up having kind of a normal life again, and I was living in New York. And I was working in a law firm, and I just wasn't happy. And I started writing to sort of try to get myself out of it, just psychologically. But it became more and more serious. And eventually, I quit my job and moved to Berlin. But even when I was doing it, there was this sort of sense at the time, I couldn't quite believe it was really happening.
And why Berlin? Why did Berlin pull you so magnetically?
I think there's this, just a very special atmosphere there right now. It's a sort of Paris in the 20s thing. There's people from all over the world coming there because rents are cheap. There's just a bohemian quality to the city. It's very spontaneous and unpredictable. There's amazing nightlife, music, arts, all kinds of things. You never really know when you go into a dorm in Berlin where it's going to lead you. And that really appealed to me. In a way, actually, New Orleans, it reminds me of a bit of New Orleans in that sense that people come there because they want something different. And when you're there, you don't feel pressure to constantly be working a 9-to-5. It gives you the sort of thinking space to work on a project.
And so then, after all this, you had a stop in New Orleans.
Yeah, it was more than a stop. I mean, in a way, it's kind of where it all came together. Because I wrote most of the book in Berlin, but, you know, I was living there in this cool, heated apartment at one point with my girlfriend, I remember, and we were just, it was dark and freezing, and she was from the South, and I had read some anecdotes, you know, about like Faulkner and Sherwood Anderson in New Orleans, and I was like, let's move back to the U.S. and let's move to New Orleans. I had never even been to New Orleans.
I love this blind faith of yours. I think it's really great.
You know, I mean, you know, when you're going to get cool bricks from the cellar to warm your place, like, what sounds better than like sipping mint juleps on like St. Charles Avenue, you know? So we eventually went there and I loved it, but my life there had sort of reached, this was really kind of the low point because I had been working for the book at that point for years. It didn't seem any, I mean, the manuscript was nearing completion, but I was actually really exhausted. And in fact, I was pretty much giving up and I wasn't sure whether I was even going to submit the book. And my mom convinced me to submit the book to an agent. So that was the period in which my life changed. I was working and living in a hotel in exchange for room and board. I had a room, but I didn't even have a fixed room. They just put me in whatever room was empty.
Oh, no.
Yeah, so, I mean, it seemed to like be this kind of pinnacle of aimlessness because I'd always been moving around. And now I just had a sort of duffel bag where I moved my stuff from room to room.
Wow.
So, you know, the place was full of characters. And I don't think anybody, you know, I told people that I was writing a book. And I would go to a coffee shop on Magazine Street and, you know, kind of try to hammer out the last draft. But I didn't really think anything was going to happen. And then I sent it in and everything changed.
Wow. And it's a great success story and a rare one, you know. Now, one of the things I love about this book, and I know it sounds just weird, but it is the title. And I love the way you use Wilfred Owen's poetry. I wonder if you'd talk about finding that title, which is so evocative.
Oh, well, thank you. For me, it's something really special, but I never quite know how it feels to other people because I have such a strong attachment to Wilfred Owen as a person and as a poet. I just always been interested in the Great War, but I think around college, I think I started reading his poetry. He's a kind of an exceptional figure. I mean, he's one of those people that gives you faith in the achievements of humanity because he was completely unknown in his life. I mean, he had no training. He wanted to be a poet very badly, and he entered the war completely unknown. And at one point, he turned to writing these poems, which have this kind of mystical beauty. And in a way, you know, they're famous for being war poetry and the best examples of war poetry, but they're also, you know, if you read this poem, it's not really the poem that the title is from. It's called Strange Meeting, and it's about Owen imagining meeting with a dead German soldier. And it's about much more than war, I think. There's a sort of a peculiar dreamlike quality to it. But I had been reading the letters of Owen, which are, he wrote all these letters to his mother, which you just can't believe that somebody could write this kind of stuff off the cuff. And it was never intended for publication, but if you read it, it's just as beautiful as his poetry. And that had sort of been a start for me for the novel, just imagining these people under these sort of circumstances, because all the Everest climbers had been in the war. And I started to think about, you know, the way that they communicated, but then I wondered what their personal lives had been like. And so the line in the poem, "I went hunting wild after the wildest beauty in the world, which lies not common eyes or braided hair, but mocks the steady running of the hour." I always thought that that verse was really mystical, and I didn't have a title for the book for a while, and one day I just kind of thought I'd use it. And in a way, I didn't quite believe it, but yeah, it stuck. Some people thought it was too long, but I stuck to my gun.
Oh, no, I think it's perfect. It captures the quest for Everest, the quest of Tristan, just that feeling that the world was changing and pulsing forward at those times. It's a lovely match, I think. And it's just a wonderful book. Once you start it, you just can't put it down. So where did you end up now?
I'm in Austin for the winter, but I have to say I'm still sort of living out of a suitcase, same as before. I think I have plans to kind of live like a normal person, but the book being published has been so wild that I haven't gotten much closer. But I tend to spend the winter in the U.S. and I go back every summer to Berlin.
Well, are you deep into the second novel now?
I was deep, but you know, it's a historical book, and it kind of picks up where the last one left off in terms of period, and so it's going to be the 1920s and 30s leading up to the World War II, but honestly, the research for this stuff is overwhelming, and I'm interested in so many things, I'm trying to narrow it down, so it's going to be a long road, and I'm hoping, you know, this book took 6 years, and I'm hoping the next one won't take anywhere near as long, but we'll see.
Me too, but I'll wait. It'll be worth it, I feel sure. We've been talking with debut novelist Justin Goh, whose new book is The Steady Running of the Hour. You can meet him Wednesday, April 16th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Thank you so much, Justin.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
The Tilted World is a wonderful novel that recreates events of the Mississippi Flood of 1927. Its authors are Tom Franklin and Beth Ann Fennelly, who live and write in Mississippi and who are spouses as well as co-authors. Tilted World is an historical novel, a love story, a look at some tough moral choices, and a wildly entertaining read that will keep you turning pages, no matter how much you think you know about that flood. Tom and Beth Ann are coming to New Orleans to take part in a special reading commemorating the flood's anniversary. Tom Franklin, Beth Ann Fennelly, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you so much, Susan.
Thanks, Susan. Great to be here.
Oh, you've both written so much. Now, Tom, you're a dazzling fiction writer, author of Crooked Letter, which I love, Poachers, and Hell at the Breach. And Beth Ann, I know you primarily as a poet, author of Unmentionables, which is my favorite, and your nonfiction work, Great with Child, Letters to a Young Mother. So how did this turn to collaborative fiction come about for you?
Well, it started in a kind of a funny place. It started with a short story that we co-wrote together, kind of on a lark, and that story wound up having a long life. It was published in the book we wrote it for, and then it was published in an anthology and another magazine, and at some point my agent, who's married to Beth Ann's agent, saw the story and called me, and he said, "You know, why don't you tell me about the story? I really like it." And I said, "Well, we just wrote it for this book, this anthology." And he said, "Well, it's more than that. This is your next book, and you're writing it together." So it was our agent's idea.
And you dedicated the book to your agent, right?
Right.
So tell us about the plotting process, and give us a sense of the storyline, if you could. Was this something you worked out all the way through at the very beginning, outlining, or did you let the story unfold as you wrote?
Well, we had both written 4 books previous to this, as you mentioned, but we had never done a big collaborative project before. So we came up with an idea that we thought would make really good sense, and it didn't end up working. The idea we came up with was we would have 2 point of view characters, a female and a male, and we were going to alternate chapters, and I was going to write the female chapters, and Tommy was going to write the male chapters, and we thought we would get the book done in about a year. And instead, that plan totally didn't work, and we couldn't get our mojo working. Tommy's book, Crooked Letter, ended up being a bigger success than the publisher expected, and they sent him out on this extended book tour. He'd just be home for a day or two, and and then they'd send it back out. And so sometimes I'd have my chapter ready for him to write the next chapter, and he wouldn't be around to do it, and just going really slow. And it got fun, Susan, when we started doing something we didn't anticipate. We ended up doing this thing we called dueling laptops, where we were kneecap to kneecap in my tiny little office with our laptop back to back, and we'd actually compose aloud and write the scenes and sentences together. And sometimes we'd each have like a little flurry of writing on our keyboard, and then we'd look up and we'd read a couple sentences to the other, and then we'd both have another little flurry. So it didn't take a year. It took close to 4 years because there was one other person the book is dedicated to. You might see the name.
Yes.
Was our surprise third baby that came along during the process of writing this novel. But we ended up finding it really fun to do that type of writing together, because the other type of writing that we had started with, I write a chapter, he writes a chapter, was just like writing always is, which is to say you're alone in a room with a white paper and you're terrified. And now I was writing with my best friends, and we had a lot of laughs, and we learned a lot, and it was fun.
Well, and so much of the time when you're writing collaborative fiction, the big problem is unity of voice and consistency of tone, and you smoothed out those things at the beginning instead of having to go back and do that.
Yeah, you know, our friends who are writers have said this really nice compliment, and they've said, I looked for the place where one voice stopped and the other started. I looked for the seams where I could tell who was writing what, and I couldn't find them. And that flatters the both of us, and I think it's because Tommy and I met the first day of graduate school, and we both went to the University of Arkansas. Tom had studied fiction, I'd studied poetry, and we kind of grew up together as writers, and we learned to read the same books and love the same books, and, oh, you've got to read this, or listen to this great sentence, and always exchanging manuscripts with each other for all these years. In a way, it's like we were preparing to write a novel together. We just didn't know that's what we were preparing for.
We had always been each other's first reader for everything. And every novel that I wrote has Beth Ann's fingerprints all over it, because she would have been there with me to talk about it at the beginning and to read early chapters and to read an early draft of it. And I'd read poems for her or essays for her. So, you know, as she said, we had been collaborating in that sense for a long time, just never this directly.
So tell us a little bit about these characters, Dixie Clay and Ingersoll. They're so memorable and they're so completely endearing. So describe how they come together and what their problems are.
Well, Ingersoll was an orphan and raised in an orphanage in Chicago. And from there, went to World War I to get a different life and to escape an early love. And he met Ham Johnson, his partner there. And from after World War I, they survive the war and become revenue agents and become very well known at that and good at that. So good that Herbert Hoover himself knows about them. And as the rains were falling and the Mississippi River is rising, they're sent down to our little fictional town of Hobnob, Mississippi, to investigate the disappearance of two other revenue agents. These guys have been in Hobnob for a couple of weeks now, and they're gone. And you know, our guy Ingersoll and his partner are sent to find them. So Ingersoll is one point of view character. The other is Dixie Clay Holliver. He's a young woman from Alabama and married very young, I think at age around 16, mm-hmm. to a guy named Jesse Swan Holliver, who's a very good-looking guy, very smooth talker. She sort of falls for his charms and doesn't see that he's kind of a shallow person, as it turns out. And she marries him, not knowing that he's the local bootlegger for Hobnob. And this isn't as unlikely as it sounds the way that the book is written. It makes good sense. And they have a baby, Jacob, who dies at 3 months old. And Jesse is now making his moonshine, her husband, and going out and selling it. She finds herself home all the time. You know, and without the baby, she discovers that Jesse's a bootlegger. And then she herself begins to make the moonshine just to have something to do with her hands and becomes really the best bootlegger in the county. So Ingersoll and Ham Johnson, you know, are coming looking for a missing revenue agent, and she actually knows something about their disappearance. And on the way, you know, of course they find the baby, and that the baby brings them to Dixie Clay.
And so much of this novel is about that longing for family. And at that time, there you were, having a baby.
Yeah, that was a pleasure, Susan, because in my life as a writing mother, so much of the time is spent tearing my gaze away from my little creature so I can get my work done. And this was this rare, beautiful intersection of my passions where I was looking at my chubby little 7-month-old baby and writing about a chubby little 7-month-old baby. And I talked with Tommy, and he and I agreed that we didn't want this baby to be a little bit of arm candy that pops up every once in a while, that becoming a mother was the transformation that Dixie Clay needed. And them falling in love was a natural disaster as much as the flood was, that it changed who they were.
Absolutely. We've been talking with Beth Ann Fennelly and Tom Franklin, co-authors of the novel The Tilted World. They'll be appearing Friday, April 18th at 7:30 at Café Istanbul as part of Yeah, You Write, a reading and multimedia event sponsored by the Podunk Writers Alliance. Thank you so much, you two.
Oh, Susan, thank you so much.
Thank you, Susan.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Today's guest, Justin Goh, reads from and signs The Steady Running of the Hour, Wednesday, April 16th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. New York Times bestselling author Sarah Vowell presents the Kylene and Bradley Beers Lecture, Wednesday, April 16th at 6 at the Woldenberg Arts Center Freeman Auditorium at Tulane University. Poet John Gary reads from and signs his new collection, Have At You Now, Thursday, April 17th at 6 at Octavia Books. Zachary Lazar signs his novel, I Pity the Poor Immigrant, Thursday, April 17th at 6 at Maple Street Bookshop. The Great Books Discussion Group has announced their reading schedule through summer of 2014. The group meets at 7 on the third Thursday of each month at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. The first meeting takes place April 17th, and the book is Love in the Time of Cholera by Gabriel Garcia Marquez. There will be a tribute reading to Bob Kaufman called Ancient Rain, Thursday, April 17th at 8 p.m. at the Goldmine Saloon. Jennifer Como discusses her novel, Life on the Edge, Thursday, April 17th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. The Podunk Writers Alliance presents its second Yeah, You Write event, Readings, Images, and Music, Friday, April 18th at Café Istanbul. The event features today's guests, Tom Franklin, Beth Ann Fennelly, along with Joseph Boyden, John Barry, Benjamin Percy, Jewel Bush, Emily Statt, and Cassie Preen. Music by DJ Sepp and images by El Casimu Harris. By admission, doors open at 7, show at 7:30. Candace Huber, founder of the blog and website fleurdelit.com and the author series Reading Between the Wines, discusses writing in the digital age at the meeting of the Southeast Louisiana chapter of the Romance Writers of America. That's SOLA. They meet Saturday, April 19th at 10 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Laura Roach Dragon reads from and signs her middle grade novel, Hurricane Boy, Saturday, April 19th from 11:30 to 1 at Maple Street Bookshop. Lenny Emanuel will read from his book, Mirrors and Lanterns, Selected Poems, plus his Squeal. That's a four-page, one-sentence belated response to Allen Ginsberg's Howl. That's Sunday, April 20th at 3 at the Maple Leaf Bar. William de Marigny Highland, a direct descendant of Bernard Xavier Philippe de Marigny de Mandeville, discusses his ancestor Monday, April 21st at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. John Griswold discusses and signs his new book, Pirates You Don't Know and Other Adventures in the Examined Life, Collected Essays, Tuesday, April 22nd at 6 at Octavia Books. And Richard Sexton, whose new book is Creole World, Photographs of New Orleans and the Latin Caribbean Sphere, signs his book Tuesday, April 22nd from 6 to 8 at the Historic New Orleans Collection's Laura Simon Nelson Galleries, 400 Charter Street. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.